Hello, welcome, and dobrodošli to Feel Slovenia, the podcast. In each episode, we will explore what I have called the world's best country, meeting locals, traveling, eating, and getting to know the very best of Slovenia. This podcast is written and hosted by me, Dr. Noah Charney, and is brought to you by the Slovenian Tourist Board. Slovenia is a nation full of amazing women. I should know, I married one. It's also a country that celebrates Women's Day on March 8th. International Women's Day is a global observance celebrated annually on the 8th of March. It commemorates the social, economic, cultural, and political achievements of women, while also advocating for gender equality and women's rights. Now let's be honest, every day should be Women's Day, because we should celebrate the wonderful women in our lives always. But since we do have a dedicated holiday here, it makes for a great opportunity to look at some of the most remarkable Slovenian women in history. Now comes the tough part, choosing who to highlight. We could easily have an entire season on remarkable Slovenian women, but here is a small example. I first spoke to Svetlana Slapšak. Svetlana is a professor of classics and a dear friend of mine, who is also co-author of one of my books, The Slavic Myths. She'll appear in the next episode as well, as she's often my go-to person when I have a question about, well, just about anything. I asked her who she'd nominate for this episode, and she suggested three literary giants.
When we speak about March 8th, the International Women's Day, we usually speak about problems, about contemporary women, about everything that concerns their social position, the health protection, and so on. This time I would like to think and to speak about women from the past in Slovenia, and especially three women whose literary work I like very much, and I think that their literary work should be somehow revived and presented to modern generations. Well, the first one is the first author of the novel in Slovenia, and it's Lojza Pesjak, and she was the novelist, and also she wrote short stories, and her maternal language was German, and she was learning Slovenian all of her life. And the other, Pavlina Pajk, was born in Italy, so her mother tongue was Italian, and she was bilingual. German, of course, and she also learned Slovenian. So we have two, we would say today, foreigners. Of course, they were not. They were women who were interested in Slovenia and its social life. They wrote novels which not me, but critics would define as love novels or trivial literature, or in all the cases, they are considered secondary writers. Well, I would like to see them in a new light, as novelists who were following some European models, West European models, who dared to write about women heroes, who dared to write about love. And Lojza Pesjak was also known for writing a drama about Prešeren, France Prešeren, the greatest Slovenian poet. And he also was teaching her not Slovenian, but English. So there was a friendship between these two persons. And her drama about Prešeren was never published and, of course, never performed. Well, I would like to see it performed. And the third woman I like very much from the Slovenian literary history is Lili Novi. Well, she is well known. She was a poetess who for the first time was going into the passion and love passion. Very daring, very subtle, and very obvious. So Lili Novi was known for another thing that she did for Slovenian literature, if you want. She was translating work of Slovenian poets and prose writers for the famous literary congress, which was held just before the Second World War in Dubrovnik, where pen writers, members of pen clubs, decided to put forward their beliefs and their positions against fascism and Nazism in Europe. And it was extremely important that the Slovenian members of PEN appeared with translation into German at this Congress, and all these translations were done by Lili Novi, the poetess.
Valeria Božić is the director of tourism for Idria. She told me about an amazing woman who also happened to be one of Napoleon's lovers.
It is well known that Napoleon and his army were present in Idria because they smuggled mercury. But it's less known the fact that he has also a mistress in Idria, whose life story remains a mystery to these days. She was a very interesting name. She was called Eva Lucia Cecilia Victoria Kraus, born into the family of the imperial and royal mining supervisor Jozef Kraus. She had a lot of charm and beauty, complemented by remarkable qualities of patience, courage, and resilience. As a child, she dreamed of a prince on a white horse, none other than the greatest European figure of the time, Napoleon Bonaparte. Even before personally meeting him, she vowed to herself to become his friend, accompanying him until death. But Emilia's life was far from a bed of roses. In her teenage years, following her father's death, she tasted a lot of poverty and the bottom rung of Idria's social ladder. Hoping for a better life for her daughter, her mother entrusted her to the care of a royal secretary of the artillery office, Philip Mainoni. Moving to Vienna, Mainoni introduced Emilia to a luxury lifestyle filled with glamorous balls among high society. Emilia quickly became one of the most sought-after dancer and women in Vienna. When Napoleon, as the victorious conqueror, visited Vienna, he attended a dance at Schönbrunn, fulfilling Emilia's dreams of their meeting. Dressed in an unusual black dress with her bold statement, long blonde hair and blue eyes, she immediately caught his attention and won him over. Shortly after Napoleon convincing Emilia to become his mistress, he installed her in his place on the outside of Paris, which deeply disappointed and saddened Emilia. Her bonnie, as she affectionately called Napoleon, was absent due to his campaigns and she became very depressed. But her love to him was so big that she decided to keep her promise and stand by him through thick and thin. She even cut her beautiful curls and, disguised as Lieutenant Emil Kraus, accompanied him in his greatest battles. In doing so, all her expectations and desires were fulfilled. With him, she experienced both moments of happiness and the declines of his glory. After Napoleon's death, Mainoni reduced her annual pensions and kept her precious jewelry, which he refused to return to her. After Mainoni's death, when she was 47 years old, the income dried up and she fell into severe financial difficulties. Besides money, she also lost all her beauty. She lived with a large number of animals, a lot of monkeys, parrots, dozens of singing birds, and around 30 dogs. That's why people called her the Countess of Dogs. She dies in Gnigl near Salzburg, physically, mentally, and financially broken. She was buried there in cemetery. Emilia Kraus was a real person born in Idria. Her painting is now preserved in the Idria Museum, while prints are also kept in Vienna. The events of Napoleon's conquest are real, but the story is product of the author's imagination.
The small city of Celje boasts several important historical figures. To learn more, I spoke with Alexander Seushuk, a local guide in Celje, who told me about Barbara of Celje, a powerful medieval aristocrat, and Alma Karlin, a world traveler, intellectual, and writer.
Our queen Barbara, she was born to the dynasty of counts and later on princes of Celje. And she was the youngest daughter of Count Hermann II of Celje. And she got married to his very good friend Sigismund of Luxembourg, who was king of Hungary at that time. She was his second wife. His first wife was Maria of Anjou, who was considered to be Hungarian noble. But when Barbara married Sigismund, She was not considered to be Hungarian noble, so the Hungarians didn't have their nobility on their throne anymore. That was kind of a problematical for Barbara's reign. Now, Sigismund did not stay just the king of Hungary, but he became the Holy Roman Emperor. Sadly, Barbara did not become the empress because at the time when he was crowned as Holy Roman Emperor in Rome, she was actually ruling the throne of Hungary in his name. That was not a good time for her because at that time there was a lot of instability within the kingdom itself. One problem was a Croatian lord who was constantly trying to set Croatian kings in the middle of her kingdom. And, well, of course, there was a retribution, and that is the reason why she's known in Croatia today as the Black Queen. Well, Sigismund became the Holy Roman Emperor, but Barbara did not stay the only the Queen of Hungary. She became also Queen of Germany and later on Queen of Czech, so three times queen. Now, she was very, very intelligent woman. She spoke seven languages. She dabbled in alchemy. Also, when she was exiled to Romania, she spent some time with very infamous family known as the family of Tepes. Well, they became allies, and when she and Sigismund co-founded the Order of the Dragon, the family was invited into that order, and because of that order, this family of Tepes also got their name. And you know their name, because in Romanian, the dragon is called Dracul, so father was called Dracul, or the dragon, and his son was called a baby dragon, or Dracula. So now you have a little bit of fiction and a little bit of history together, so that you better understand. Well, after the death of her husband Sigismund, Barbara kind of still held to her political influence, which was not so good for her son-in-law, Albert of Habsburg. And what they did to her was they took away all of her dowry, all of her estates. And at that time, she goes to Poland, where her cousin was queen before that. It is not actually clear what happened there, but it is presumed that she arranged the marriage of her granddaughter, Elizabeth of Habsburg, to be married back on the Polish throne where her cousin was queen before that. Elizabeth on the Polish throne had 13 living children, and that line can be traced all the way to the British royal family through late Crown Prince Philip. So we can say that between Prince William and Harry and Barbara of Celje, there is exactly 20 generations. So here's to the first great lady of Celje. Alma Karlin is our world traveler. Again, a very, very amazing woman. In 1919, she leaves Celje and goes to London to study languages. Actually, she was a writer. She wrote books. She wrote for the local newspaper. Now, she actually comes from Slovenian family, but she was very pro-German because at that time, Celje had two communities, so German and Slovenian. Now, she loved to travel, and she traveled to London. There she started to learn languages. Till the end of her lifetime, she had the certificate for 10 foreign languages, which is, again, amazing. And from London, she decided to travel around the world. So she went from London to Savona to South America. She didn't like it there. So then afterwards, she went to San Francisco. There she ran out of money, but that was no problem for Alma. So what she did was she just took a job, started translating, writing, got more money, and from San Francisco, she traveled to Japan. In Japan, she stayed for 2 years, and actually, the only pictures on which she is smiling are actually coming from Japan. Fun fact. From Japan, afterwards, she traveled to Australia, New Zealand, New Guinea, and also there is, from New Guinea, there comes a myth about Alma. You see, as a child, Alma had polio. She was very skinny, her face was not symmetrical, and according to legend, in New Guinea, she was captured by cannibals. And when they saw her so skinny, not so healthy looking, they decided it's perhaps better not to eat her and just let her go. So she travels onwards to India and Karachi. In Karachi, she got a letter from her mother, Willibalda, that she's mortally sick, her mother, and that she has to come home. Yes, she comes home. Willibalda, her mother, still needs around 4 years to die. So yeah, that's Slovenian mothers for you. Worried sick constantly. But her adventure does not stop there. Now you see, in 1941, when Germans come back to Celje, although Alma was very pro-German, she had a lot to say against the regime of Adolf Hitler. And when the Germans came back to Celje in 1941, they had a list with them for all the people that need to be arrested. And Alma was number three on that list. So she got arrested. She was already in kind of a jail in between before. For, it was the camp for the people to be deported to Dachau. At that time, her friends from Germany actually intervened and they saved her. From there, she goes to Bela Krajina and joins the partisan movement. Now, the idea is to go to Italy, to Savona, and travel around the world again. But sadly, there she gets sick. She gets tuberculosis. And after the war, she returns home, buys a house in Pečovnik. This is a small, beautiful village above the city of Celje. And there she lives with her friend, Thea, all the way till 1950s. Well, the last years of her life, she was very poor. She was forced to sell most of the artifacts that she brought from her traveling. Today, we managed to find and buy back most of them, and they are exhibited in our regional museum of Celje. But sadly, in 1950, Alma dies. Now, again, another very amazing woman here in Celje.
Alma Karlin is about to become even more well-known, as the AI helper on the Slovenian tourism website will be named Alma after her. We could easily have a full episode on Slovenia's female athletes. I've written a feature on ski champion Tina Maze for The Atlantic magazine. Anyone who watched Petra Majdic win a bronze medal at the Vancouver Olympics in 2010, cross-country skiing with a broken rib, knows the meaning of true heroism. I get goosebumps just thinking about it. Judoist Urška Žolnir won a gold medal in the 2012 Olympics. Urša Bogataj took home Olympic gold for ski jumping in 2022, and Emma Klinec was the first Slovenian female ski jumping world champion in 2021. Janja Garnbret is the best competitive climber in history, male or female, the only person to have won all major titles possible in sports climbing. Freediver Alenka Artnik has broken world records and dived more than 100 meters down on a single breath. For a previous episode, I spoke to downhill skier Ilka Stuchets. I asked her to walk me through a race day, everything but the race itself. Her reply highlights just how much effort goes into her remarkable success. We tend to think only about the 2 minutes or less of the race and forget the colossal effort that leads up to those 2 minutes. There is a lifetime of brilliance and hard work that's too often invisible for all the parts you see on TV, or the equivalent high-visibility success of an athlete, chef, writer, politician, or any woman in the spotlight.
Yeah, actually, I mean, on a race day, like you said, you don't really see much. You see us maybe like a few short seconds on the course inspection or when we are getting ready to start. But yeah, the whole day, it's actually full with skiing, with everything, what's going on before the race and after the race, not just this, let's put it to like maximum 10 minutes, maybe when you're really like high focus before the race and when you're racing. So I would say I'm quite an early bird. So I love to wake up quite early, like long before inspection or whatever, long before leaving the hotel. I do all my exercises that I do every morning to wake up my body, to get the joints going and stuff like that, really to fully wake up already before I leave the hotel. Then, yeah, we would come to the skiing area. I would warm up a little bit more there, put on my equipment. Then maybe, well, it depends if I go pre-skiing or like doing the warm up on the slope with skiing right away, or we go for the inspection first. I mean, also inspection, you are inspecting the course between 45 minutes and 1.5 hours, and then you ski it in less than 2 minutes. So yeah, you really need to like have a look at all the small details, because later you will be passing by pretty quickly actually. And you'll have to know everything what's coming and count that in your race to get down as fast as possible, of course. Then, yeah, the routine would be kind of a take some time before going to the start of the race. Again, change the equipment for racing, like the real racing suit and the protection, whatever it's needed or whatever some I prefer. Then, yeah, then the part you see on the TV, getting ready and racing. And then afterwards, well, it depends. But usually, yeah, we would hang out in the finish a bit just to, I mean, to see how the race develops, to make some interviews or whatever you need to do. Then go back to the hotel, go to the ski room, sometimes help unpack the skis, talk with the technician, go for lunch, have a little break, maybe 1 hour or something like that, take a rest. And then again, same old, some physiotherapy, some physical training, video analysis of the race or the trainings or the meeting, whatever comes tomorrow, if it's another race or we are moving to another place, then dinner. And yeah, you are more than ready to sleep.
It's similar with Slovenia's most famous chef, Anna Roš. You can go back and listen to a full episode in which I interviewed her, but she's a fine example. She is one of the most famous chefs in the world, full stop, and certainly among the top few most famous female chefs.
I'm interested, how long was the process and what did it entail to make Hisha Franco feel like your restaurant once you took over in the kitchen? Was it very quick or was it a slower process?
I think it was, is 10 years short to long process? I don't know. So when I started helping in Gustina Franco, when Walter's father was still running it and Walter's mom was running the kitchen, you know, I was a student and I was doing precisely what I was asked for. But I remember, because I'm always a little bit revolutionary or rebel, as you say, I was already at the time like suggesting some changes that I thought would be crucial to make the place be run better or of a higher quality. And of course, you know, that was a kind of a generational gap. But sometimes I was stubborn and I made it happen. So a few years later, we took over the restaurant. And then 2 years later, I took over the kitchen. And I believe from there to the next 10 years, I was struggling with this phenomena that says my head knows precisely what I want, but my hands cannot follow. So I think I needed around 10 years to coordinate my hands and my brain to make it really happen. And once I was capable of realizing myself, my thoughts, I think I felt the dishes, the kitchen, the place as mine. And this is actually the moment when I started putting the soul to the walls, to the choice of the table or chair or cutlery, to finally come to the point that, you know, with the designer, we are making our own line of crockery and so on and so on.
That actually links into my next question I was going to ask, but you've already started to answer it. Do you feel you would have benefited from more formal training as a chef, or is part of your strength that you're largely self-taught?
I think it's both. That's the only answer I can give. Of course, not belonging to any culinary school, lack of the classical education, I mean, gastronomic or culinary education, makes me be completely different. So my cuisine from the beginning has been having a completely different approach than most of the chefs have. Sometimes, I don't know, the recipes happened and they were like the other way around. And people would be like, how do you do a mayonnaise? And they were like, well, because originally the recipe goes differently. But, you know, this is like when I was in a fourth class of the gymnasium, I had the highest scores in mathematics, but the professor couldn't believe how I got to the result because the result was right. But the formula was completely mine. On the other side, of course, you know, classical education gives you quicker access to the result. So you are not rediscovering cold water or warm water every single day. So I think there are pluses and minuses. But of course, if I was doing a gastronomic school, I would be a completely different profile of a chef. I don't think I would reach what I have reached, because when you struggle and you fight, you actually have this very strong evolutionary process. While when you're in a comfort zone of your knowledge or whatever, of course, you know, you don't struggle and fight so much. So also the results come slower, or maybe they never come.
I'll take the opportunity to name just a few more, as the list could go on and on. Who would have anticipated that Slovenian women would carve their place in the nascent days of Hollywood? Yet that's precisely what happened. Rosalia Sršin, known as Zalka Sršin, from Žužemberk, embarked on a voyage to San Francisco with her aunt at the tender age of 16. At the time, she barely spoke English, and she was even homeless for a period. But her determination to make a life for herself won out. She managed to get a role in a film and eventually appeared in 20 silent films under the screen name Zala Zarana, which in Slovene means beautiful at dawn. She portrayed seductresses, cabaret performers, and even was in a Western. Her most notable cinematic feat was her role in Todd Browning's The Snow. She forged friendships with legends like Laurel and Hardy as well. Also a star of the early screen, Ita Rina emerged as the undisputed luminary of the silver screen during the 1920s and 30s, often mentioned in the same breath as other stars like Greta Garbo and Marlene Dietrich. Originating from the Karst region, this 20-year-old ventured to Berlin, the cinematic hub of Europe at the time, where she swiftly secured a role in a film. Her trajectory soared, notably propelled by her performances in Eroticon of 1929, and Tonka of the Gallows in 1930. Despite enticing offers from Hollywood to further her career in the United States, she opted to marry and relocate to Belgrade. Delve into the captivating narrative of this cinematic enchantress at the Museum of Slovenian Film Actors in Divača. Dr. Franja Bojc-Bidovec was renowned for her stewardship of the Franja Partisan Hospital, a poignant symbol of compassion amidst the turmoil of the Second World War. Nestled within a secluded ravine near Cerkno, this hospital became a sanctuary where countless partisan lives were saved during the Second World War. Its namesake, Dr. Franja Bojc-Bidovec, was a remarkable female physician, and she assumed leadership of the hospital with unwavering dedication and selflessness, overseeing its growth and development. Prior to the war, she had confronted myriad challenges that ultimately steered her towards a path of medicine. Finally, since I'm an art historian and the author of a book called Brushed Aside, The Untold Story of Women in Art, I'm partial to Ivana Kobilca. Kobilca was a pioneering artist who boldly challenged the societal norms prevalent at the close of the 19th and the dawn of the 20th centuries, opting to live by her own principles. She embraced a career in painting at the remarkably young age of 16 and produced a body of work that runs up to more than 350 paintings. Her notable works include Summer and Women Ironers, both showcased at an international exhibition in Paris. But she is particularly revered for Kafetkarica, the coffee drinker, a painting she held dear, steadfastly refusing to part with it during her lifetime. It's now considered the Mona Lisa of Slovenia and the highlight of the National Gallery in Ljubljana. This selection of remarkable Slovenian women just scratches the surface. Whether you admire their careers or even decide to marry one, Slovenian women deserve a world of respect and praise. With this, we wish you a happy International Women's Day, or Dan Žena. Vala and thank you for listening to Feel Slovenia, the podcast. This podcast is brought to you by the Slovenian Tourist Board and was written and presented by Dr. Noah Charney. Please subscribe to get each new episode and tell all of your friends interested in travel and all things Slovenia. If you'd like to learn more, visit slovenia.info. For more information, you're welcome to follow our social media channels, Feel Slovenia on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, LinkedIn, YouTube, and TripAdvisor.